So we begin the beginning of the ninth parak. Let's start by reading the Mishnah, and then we can explore. I deliberately not starting with the beginning Gemara, because as interesting and as important, and really interesting and important, we have to do it and discuss it as it relates to the nature of Kiddushin, the nature of Gerushin. First, I want to see the earlier layer of materials because it appears in four different iterations. It appears in the Sifrei, it appears in the Tosefta, it appears in the Yerushalmi, and it appears on Daf Pei Gimel Amud Aleph in the Bavli. So let's start with the Mishnah. Daniel, can I ask you to read?
Sure.
So the Gemara is obviously going to explore this, but translate however you would like for now.
When he divorces his wife and says to her, "You are permitted to every man except for Oni, Rabbi Eliezer."
So you've already taken a stance.
Okay,
I'm sorry, I didn't ask you to read the beginning of the Gemara. You made a choice in translation. The Gemara has a question. You weren't expected to look at it. Maybe I shouldn't even tell you about it. But I'll just tell you about it, but I will not discuss a word right now. One interpretation of the Mishnah is you are permissible to marry everyone, you are muteris kadam except so-and-so, which is the way you translate. The alternative the Gemara has, which is not the way they accept, ultimately, other except, ACC, is you are muteris kadam on the condition that you don't marry so-and-so, almanas. Now, there is a very big difference between those two, there might be a very big difference between those two. It's a machlokas harishon and what the maskan of the Gemara is. But there's a very big difference between those two. But we're not going to discuss it. So we'll just accept your translation of accept, E-X-C-E-P-T, and move on from there. So what's the din if you give a get? But the get is now harayim uteres lechol adam. It's harayim uteres lerov adam. Okay, go ahead. So I'm sorry, Rabbi Matir?
Yes,
all right. So what does it mean, Rabbi Lezer Matir? Yes, Sandy?
That's the question. Mm-hmm. If so, it's muted, but the question they're answering. Like, they're saying, if you do this, then it's good or it's not good. Why don't they just say, you can or cannot, like, put this into a get?
Right.
Why they're saying, you can not get it, and now what? Now are you allowed to do this or that?
Would anybody like to answer that question? It's a totally valid question. Somebody else like to answer the question. I mean, it's not really a question, should it?
Like, travel fees are expensive, so now that you have this yet, can you reuse it properly?
Yeah. Try it. You want to weigh in?
A way to gain more dinim?
Like, I'm sorry?
Just a way of getting more dinim?
This is the way all of Mishnah works. Right? It's not a question on this Mishnah. Right? It's a question generally. Why do they choose to use often the casuistic formulation as opposed to didactic formulation?
No, I don't get that question.
No?
Well, I don't understand what you just said, so I don't know whether or not that was my question.
You're asking, why doesn't it... What ask your question again.
To say there's a case where someone wrote in it that you can't get married to this other guy, and now they're saying, is this a good document or is it not a good document? Why don't they just say, you're allowed to write this in a document, or you're not allowed?
That's not my
question. I was answering your question. That when we talk about a casuistic, let's say ancient Near Eastern law, is always, if such and such happens, then this is the result. This is the penalty, this is the punishment, this is the payment, whatever. That's the way it works. The Torah has two kinds. It has the casuistic, the other one is didactic, where sometimes the Torah says, read lots of things in Parshas Mishpatim. If such and such happens, then this is the din. Sometimes the Torah dictates what you should actually do. You should do this. and Shamar Ser Mashavas LaKadoshah, not just or Lo Sasech Ol Malacha. It's not. It's also Kol Osem Malacha Be'al Shabbos Matzimas. Well, that may not be perfect, but many things the Torah says: do X, don't do Y. Sometimes the Torah says, if this is what happened, then the following is the result. So the Mishnah has both formulations. When the Mishnah wants to tell you that you do the following, you don't do the following, it uses a participle. You know, orlar ba'asar botin esachametz or hanim. It will also sometimes use the formulation, you know, if you did such and such, what's the din? I don't know what the pattern. Now, some things don't lend themselves so easily to that. Some things do lend themselves more easily to doing both. But you have both formulations in the Mishnah. This is a very fairly common thing. What is usually assumed when the formulation is given this way? That someone, if you do X and X, it is
only
b'di'evet. It's not always true, but it's a starting point. It's a starting point in the discussion. Right? The last Mishnah in the Perek was b'shamayim lo yigarish adam ishpel ela. Right? That's didactic. That's not casualistic. That's saying these are the rules. This is when you can divorce. This is when you can't divorce. This is saying if somebody divorced their wife and they did this, what is the din? You get both, but that's standard Mishnah. Daniel, what was your
question? I also want to follow up that last Mishnah first. My question is, how does the language of doesn't the language of Hamidarish show that Amar Lahariya and Charles Kaladam? It's unnecessary and confusing. I would want to use that.
Omer the Ishtel?
Hamadir Get the Ishtel, Be Amar Lah, whatever. The fact that he uses the language of Hamidarish is you one who effected a divorce.
Yes. So I think you have to understand what Megarish here means.
Is just summed up?
No, it means he wrote a get.
That's all.
He wrote a get and he handed it over
to her. Your initials in general, they just use that word instead.
Yeah, you have a homework assignment. Go back, it's a quick scan. But Hamagarish is a person who wrote a get, handed it to his wife, and said.
So Hamagarish is not necessarily someone who got divorced.
Correct. It means someone who is trying to get divorced, who is going through the process to get divorced, and has done the steps that get divorced, except that he did something.
I would even think that if you just start three words later, you would know the context. Omer the Isha, Hareya Bichar the Kol Adam Ella, right? There seems to be something.
You'll say because we're learning Maseches Gittin, so we're Asukin Ba'usa Inyan.
It does strike me strange.
So, before, have you learned all the Mishnayos in the Maseches? So you have to go back. And some of them, you will find Hakosei Get Le'isho, but I think that you have to, and as I suspect that it's going to be Hamagarish, is because he has actually written a proper get. And he has given the get. And the only problem is that verbally speaking, because that's clear from the second half of the Mishnah, right, if you wrote it in the get, Chacham would say, nothing doing. You can't have a do-over. See, when you write it in the get, and you say, or afutzmi, so we say, sorry, no good, buddy. Oh, so you say, okay, give me that back, try again. It's clear it's Baal Peh, and he's gone through what looks like a perfect good gerushin. He wrote the get, the hechsher. He gives the get. He says, "Harei mitzvos chadam," except, but he puts in a but. So I think you have to look and see each one when one of the stages that the mishnah used that. Fine.
That
motif
is when sort of gerushin was already effective.
You mean that's a case where he's been successful already? That's the mishnah in the fourth or fifth parak. What's that?
Saying it did work.
He already the divorce has gone through.
Okay,
got it. So you have to really just go back to the Mishnayos and collate the verbs and see, and it'll probably answer the question.
That's my follow-up question before. When you said your piece about the characteristic of didactic laws, how do we relate that to that?
In other words, firstly, I'm going to operate with, I think, the universally held assumption that rule doesn't apply by Dine Mamonos. You look at Tosis on Dabesim and Aleph, and then I think on Gimel Adam, there's a little Tosis. In Oshim and Hadin, does not apply to the Mamonos. It's only Malchus and Nisa. And yes, the Gemara, that's the whole point, right? If the Torah says that if it makes the following statement, and it can't find, for example, you have to find what's an example. But if you find the examples of the Arayos, so the Torah only describes the punishment, but it doesn't actually describe there's no Losa, so they'll go hunting for it. That's exactly what they will do. They will go hunting for the Asara, and in some cases, the most famous one, Bitomei Anusasa. It never says in the Torah, you're not allowed, it talks about not having a sexual relationship with your wife's daughter, maybe it even says your daughter from your wife. But it doesn't talk about, let's say you had a daughter out of wedlock. Does the erva of Dito apply there as well? The answer is yes. Well, how do we know that? The Gemara says that we learn Hena, Hena, and Zima, Zima. It's a double Zereshav. I'm not mistaken. One is, I could be wrong on this. One's for the Asar, right? One's for the Onesh. So, no, they absolutely, if it were given casuistically, you have to find then, somewhere, you have to find a Asar. Yes. But an Asar is didactic. What?
The Chazal themselves were uncomfortable with the idea of casuistic law, right?
I don't know that is. I have always seen Inosha Lenke Masirin as a broader moral principle, but here used exegetically. Because the fact is, if you tell someone that if they tell you, if the cop says to you, if you cross this line, we're going to arrest you, does the cop need to say to you, you may not cross this line? Isn't it implicit in?
Again, then why do you need?
So that's why I say. So that's why. So we say it by Mamanos, and I don't know why. I don't know what the underlying principle is there, but that's why I said it seems to be a more exegetical rule. Look, the truth is the Pshan in the words of Ein Onshel and Kemashirin means that you can't punish somebody without giving them warning them, right? Chazal take that to mean Ein Onshel unless you have a technical ashara. So the moral point we all understand is that you cannot. I'm sure there's some constitutional rule, ex post facto, where you make up the rule afterwards, you make up the punishment afterwards, it's not okay. We understand that. Chazal turn it into an exegetical method as well, where it's not enough to see the punishment, which I would say is casuistic, you also have to see the azar. But I don't really know why. Okay. I have the fact that it doesn't apply by Mamanos, but it does by Malchus, it means that may speak to a general aversion. The Chazal clearly have very strong hesitations about the death penalty. The only, I'm not going to discuss this because I don't know anything about it because I don't think there are any sources, except that the only death penalty some of Chazal thought was a good idea was murder. That was as a deterrent. But outside of that, there's not seen the Tanaim thought very highly of capital punishment. I think they seem to see the Torah's capital punishment as hortatory as opposed to legal or actually designed to be. An exhortation, sort of speaking to the severity of the sin and exhorting us not to do it because it's such a bad thing because it deserves the death penalty is the way you would say it. I don't know why it says Hamagarish specifically that term, but that is this type of presentation the Mishnah Sanhedrin is very common. So now, go ahead. Which obviously means, and is clear from the next line too, it wasn't written in the get, it was just he gave her a get that was written properly and just said, though, oh, by the way, this should only work for everybody except for.
And just to clarify, this is the way you should read this mission is.
Linguistically, no, but exegetically, yes.
Right.
Now, the formulation of the Mishnah, you can't tell that. You have to stop and think, well, Ketzad Yasa, well, that's only for the Chachamim.
Right.
Rabbi Eliezer said to get work. Linguistically, syntactically, no. It's not a continuation, but obviously it is. Exegetically, it is. Okay, go ahead. Okay. So, in other words, once it's written into the get is possible from the get go.
And of course, this is also a part of
the Yes, because it is not entirely. I think the Gemara is going to have a discussion about that. That is not so possible. Right. Yes, Jeff.
Doesn't that have to be written in Shema? Because if you just erase it, and then it's fine in the end.
But the rest of the get was written in Shema. In other words, here the problem is you wrote a little bit too much. You wrote that the get was written for this man to divorce his wife. And it was written the Shema. The problem is there's an invalidating clause, or disqualifying clause, and it's always the clause. The rest of the get, presumably, is written the Shema. I assume that the reason why it's no good for the Chachamim, and it could be even for Rabbi Eliezer, is because a get that has it written in it is no longer a get krisus. In other words, it could be that everybody would agree. Even could be, I could construct a logic that says even Rabbi Eliezer would agree that the get has to be a sefer krisus, but the mesina doesn't have to be a total severance. Yeah.
Isn't your response to Jake that it's not about Mishnah, it's about the get not being a get creature? Yeah. Doesn't that assume certain things about what Mishnah means? Meaning, like, couldn't you say, we haven't really defined Mishnah in any sort of conceptual or more theoretical sense yet, but couldn't you say that writing this for some reason, if you had that, if you had it in mind, this is going to be what the divorce entail, that's not really understanding what Mishnah is.
So let me put it to you this way. Lishma encompasses different things. Lishma, it has to be l'shem gerushin. It can't be l'slam. Right? Look at the first mishnah in the third parak. The first mishnah in the third parak defines four gittin that are not considered lishma. First, the sofer is just training his scribes and they're practicing, and they write, and he picks this name. You know, Reuven Goldberg is divorcing Leah Feinberg, and the guy hears, oh, that's my name, that's my wife's name. Yeah, it's a good yaakov. Can I have a piece of paper when you're done with it? But that's one thing. That's not even written l'shem gerushin. Then, all the subsequent cases are, it's l'shem, a different Yosef ben Shimon, so it's not for me, and then it goes to, it's written for this guy, and one of his wives who both have the same name, he wanted to divorce the older one, obviously he's got a fetish from the people that in Leah Rachel, whatever they are, and instead of giving it to Leah, he changes his mind. He comes home, Leah Rachel made the pasta, Leah Rachel the younger made the broccoli. He's not happy about the broccoli, so he changes his mind. He wants to divorce Leah Rachel the younger, right? So the Mishnah says that's no good because it was written for the older one. And then the final case is when he hasn't decided. He wants to get rid of one of his wives, but he's not sure which one it is. He says Those are the four cases. The last three. So you could say it is a question of Lishma. But I said the same thing from a different angle. It's not l'shem ishra ishra, and it's written l'shem gerushin, but it's not a proper gerushin. In other words, a gerushin that's not total is not called krisus. In other words, I wrote it to divorce my wife, but I thought divorcing my wife meant I could have her, you know, still attached to me in certain ways and not in others, and that's actually not called gerushin. So I agree. It is a l'shma chisaron because l'shma encompasses different elements.
I don't know. I was asking.
It does.
Because this might include things other than just who it's about. And you're saying yes.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
So basically, everybody writes a debt, every sofer writes a debt, needs to be totally like a baki and all the halacha are appearish. And if it's not, then they're not doing it in the shema because they don't know all the details.
No. What I'm saying here is that if you're writing it the shame again, that has an exception in it, you might be wrongly sincere and well-intended, but that's not called krisus, that's not called gerushin, and therefore it was written l'shem something else.
So I'm saying, you need to understand all of
them. A lot. Well, I mean, the answer is yes. So for Sofer who write, I don't know that Sofer who write are all baki and all of hechas gerushin. The Mesader Haget.
We don't want to know the
Negerishim. No. I think the Mesader Haget is the person who knows all of it. The Sofer knows how to write a get. He knows to write it the Shema. It's very hard to mess up a Kiddushin. You have to work really hard to mess up a Kiddushin. Right? You know, you have to work really, really hard to mess up a Kiddushin. Gerishim has more requirements, but a Sofer who's trained, you know, and he's given the names, and they're spelled this way, and he's told this man, this woman, and they both say they want the Gerishim. The sofer is not going to mess up, generally speaking, the gerushin, because his role is fairly simple and fairly straightforward. Right? He has to know how to write the get. He has to know what to write in the get. He has to understand the get and the shema. But once he's doing that, basically, that's his job. It's the mesader haget who's got to know how you give the get, all those things. So I don't think there's so much in the shema. This is not being the same krisus is such a core issue in gerushin that when you don't write it the same krisus, it's not written, it's not a get, right? Just as if a man writes a get, thinking that this is the way you're going to marry a woman with this document, getting about what he thinks about the words mean. If a man writes such a thing, that's not the shame gerushin, that's the shame kiddushin. So what if he is writing for this man, this woman, but he thought you're writing the shtar as a celebration of the 50th wedding anniversary? That's also not the shame gerushin. So what if he writes it so that she will take this piece of paper and be allowed to marry everybody except for so-and-so? So if that's not called krisus, it's also not the shame gerushin.
I guess I'm just asking a more general question about the word the shema and shas. Like if I tie my tithis, the shame itself, I don't really understand most of it. a lot better about this.
Right. Doesn't matter.
Does that still work? Does that not?
Yeah, I think that works.
Okay, so the definition of Ishma is local.
Yes, yeah, it absolutely it's going to be local. I suspect that most things Lishma are really just L'shem Mitzvah. Here, the Lishma again, and there's Lishma, by the way, the Shtar Kiddushin as well. There are those, by the way, who I've heard in the past, I don't know many serious about, as an egalitarian way of let's do a Shtar Kiddushin rather than Kesef Kiddushin. And I have no objections per se, other than the fact that it violates Minhag Yisrael on the theoretical grounds, but on practical grounds, you know, there are lots of Rabbanim who Masada Kiddushin who don't really know what they're doing, but it's hard to mess up a Kiddushin when it's Kiddushin Kesef. When it's Kiddushin Shtar, it's really easy to mess up a Kiddushin. So it's for practical reasons that it's really not a good idea. So yeah, but outside of that, the Shema by mitzvahs tends to be fairly simple. Right? The Shem Mitzvah Matzah, you don't need to know all the Kavanas, you know, Elyonim for the Matzah. You don't need to know all of Hilchos Matzah. You need to know enough Hilchos Matzah and that it becomes Chametz. And you understand that when you're rolling, and you're baking the Shem Mitzvah Matzah because people will use it for all Seder. But yes, this is a more complicated Lishma. Yeah. Okay. So now we begin, and I don't want to look at the Gemara, I want to look at, let's start with the Sifrei. From a chronological perspective, it is interesting to think about the order of these things. This is obviously all the same Brisa that has four different presentations with obviously an enormous amount of overlap. Which is probably, I would say, the most original. When I say original, I mean which is the one least likely to have been touched up. And when I say touching up a brisa, it's part of the process of interpretation, of making the brisa make sense. So which is the one least likely to be touched up and which is the one most likely? And I believe you will find this statistically be the case, Jay?
The Yerushalmi is probably
that is correct. Okay, that enterprise. The Yerushalmi is the one that is least likely to be touched up. Now, which is the one that's most likely to be touched up? The Bavli. And when you deal with the Tosefta, and the Sifrei, I'm not as expert in the Sifrei to make a judgment, but the Tosefta, I can tell you the following. In the Tosefta, it actually often, not always, sometimes it's even flipped. Sometimes it makes no difference, but if it often breaks down across Kisfeya. There are two major manuscripts of the Tosefta. Only one is on all of the Tosefta, and the one that's on all of the Tosefta, which is the one that is less likely to be touched up when you look at yourselves, is Savyad Vienna. That's what Lieberman used as the base for his everything that he did. Of course, he never got to. He died after he had started Rabbi Basra, at least as far as what was published posthumously. Professor Shama Friedman published Rabbi Basra, but it's a very thin volume, the notes, because Lieberman hadn't finished at least the commentary. And that was it. Now, given that he never got to Zvachim, Lieberman could have chosen either manuscript as the base text. The other one was Saviad Erfurt, there was a Talmud Chacham and scholar, Shlomo Zuckermandel, I think it was, who discovered the Saviad Erfurt of the Tosefta, and he was so excited by it, and he wrote a single volume edition. You probably can't get it at the Sfarim Sof, probably hard to find in print. But he has a single volume edition where he used Saviad Erfurt. I think it was because he discovered it, he was so excited by it. He used it as the base text for the beginning part of his edition until Zvachim, where it no longer existed, and then he reverted to Vienna. The only other meaningful witness that they talk about is Diflis Rishon, the first printing of the Tosefta, which was, I believe, printed along also with the first printing of the Rif. And I think the 1520s and Mendelssohn might be off on those dates. So they talk about usually three witnesses for most of Shas, Erfurt, Vienna, and Diflis Rishon. There are other partial Kisayat of Tosefta. I know there's a Kisaviyat London, I think, on Zerayim, maybe Moed. Lieberman used whatever existed. But Vienna tends to be less touched up, less like the Bavli. Erfurt, which is in probably Germany or Austria somewhere. It's called, the manuscripts get their name just because the library or museum which they found, that's the only reason. Nothing to do with where or when they were written. And so Erfurt tends to be more edited towards the Bavli. You know, when the Bavli will make an Ukimta and a Tosefta, it's more likely to show up in Erfurt than Vienna, but sometimes it happens the other way, but it's usually, that's the way it is. The Sifrei, I don't know enough about, but I do know that it to me, shows, firstly, the Sifrei, as presented to us, is citing the Mishnah. Often you get little tzitutim, little notations, or kibitzan, or at the end, you know, as we have. It's clear to me that the Sifrei, even though there was a Sifrei probably in the Tannaitic period, the Sifrei that we have is dependent heavily upon the Mishnah, and I suspect it is, it again falls in that middle category between Bava and Yerushalmi. It falls in the same sort of general place of the Tosefta that it tends to be less edited than the Bavli, but more edited, much more than Yerushalmi. But if you want to look at what tends to be the least touched up part, it will be the Yerushalmi. Okay, it happens to be in this sugya. There is a brisa that the Yerushalmi doesn't have that the Bavli does have that Lieberman will suggest. It's in the Tosefta. It is in our Tosefta, and it's in the Bavli. And he thinks that it's a Babylonian brisa, which is why the Yerushalmi discusses the issue, as some of you spent a lot of time this morning trying to figure out what it was. It's in the Tosefta. The Yerushalmi clearly does not have that brisa, but he thinks it's a Babylonian Amora who is Rabbi Yirmiyah. You know Rabbi Yirmiyah was a Babylonian Amora. He is Rabbi Yirmiyah, Rabbi Yirmiyah, because he made Aliyah. He's also the author of the famous statement of Chad Minayim Kutrei Minan, that one Israeli is worth as much as two Babylonians, but when one of us goes there, one of us is worth as much as them, which of course is a wonderful autobiographical statement. Anyway, so Rabbi Yirmiyah he's a Babylonian Amora who's made Aliyah. It's important, by the way, it is, you can see here, if you're trying to analyze the sugya carefully and thinking about the relationship, here it's where it's important to know certain aspects which some people would call mechkar. I don't think this is mechkar, right? The Rishonim are very well aware of the biographies of the Amorai that's presented to us in the Gemara, and this Ramban, the Ramban in Perek Kira, and what is a very major machlokas halacha lemaisa of Hadapaskin, the Ramban opts arguing that there are multiple versions of Rabbi Yochanan quoted in the Bavli, and the Ramban says, well, we should follow the citations of the Eretz Yisrael Amoraim, who were Rabbi Yochanan's students, rather than the Babylonian Amoraim citations, that both are quoted in the Bavli, right? So being aware of the biography and the history of these Amoraim actually can be very, very important. I'm not saying it's not every day, but I know in the Beis Medrash, one of the tendencies is that all time stands still. Right? If you listen to, there's a beautiful piece of the Rav when he spoke at a Pidyon HaBen in the early 70s. It's probably one of the few things in English of the Rav, of recorded speeches. So it's on, you can find it online. And the Rav speaks about, I mean, if only we could all live like this. The Rav speaks about, he sits down in the shir room, and then the door opens, and then Reb Chaim walks in. And then the Tzos walks in. It's really a powerful, powerful description. But it is the nature of the Beis Medrash that often sees us in conversation with previous generations, which we are. Sometimes you can make the mistake of collapsing chronology. And chronology really does matter, and it matters even in this context. So, in terms of what seems to have been most edited, what least edited, so the Bavli, the Bryce, is going to be the most likely touched up. And it's not, by the way, this is a case where not, I mean, the Yerushalmi least so, and the other sources in between. This happens, the case of the Bavli, I don't want to say, I won't say anything further. So let's start, however, in the middle. Let's start with the Sifrei. Okay, so let's begin with the Sifrei. Who would like to read the Sifrei for me? Right? Go ahead. I know.
No.
Krisus, She Krisus means it has to actually be severed.
Why would that necessary?
What's that?
What?
It's just the way, it's a literary setup, because what is the punchline at the end? Ein zekrisus? Or how is zekrisus? That's why, it's just a setup to that.
Right.
Okay? So, mikana ta omer.
Is that, by the way, the sort of repeating I have in the crisis, is that editing this phrase, sort of like, Jesus was not in other versions?
Why is it not in other versions? What is the difference in the presentation between the Sifrei and all the other versions? This is just a genre question. I think genre is the right thing. Yeah. What's that, Yoni? Correct. The difference between the Sifrei and all the other versions is the Sifrei is Medrash Halacha. The base text of this is the difference between Midrash and Mishnah. And there's much debate is which is the original form. But the point is, the Mishnah is interested in a din. And then the Gemara is invoked as a source for the din. Right? The Tanaim are you and Rabbi, whereas the Sifrei, the Medrash Halacha, its goal in theory, doesn't always do this fully, is to go pasuk by pasuk and interpret word by word. So that's why you start out with a deeper mass of krisos. So that teaches us sheyehei krisos, which means it has to be a severance. And now, go ahead. Mikana to Omer. Right. So if it is something that she potentially could see, the Gemara will give more examples, but if it's something that she could potentially see heter in her lifetime, then that's called krisus. The fact that it's not immediate doesn't matter. If there is no way she, in other words, in other words, if the clause will expire in her lifetime, then, no, I shouldn't say it that way. If the restriction will be lifted in her lifetime, that's the way I would put it, then it is considered krisus. If it's not, then it's not krisus. Daniel?
Do we know when we're going to die?
What's that?
Do we know when we're going to die?
No, but we can hypothesize. So the point is...
What's the cutoff
point? No, the point is that if she dies, she will never in her lifetime be able to go to Beis Avila.
No, look, if he says to her,
I understand. I don't remember if the Gemara has cases like that. I think if it were to say for the next 300 years, we would say...
Okay, but I'm asking something that's reasonable, but not necessarily...
I think that that's krisus. But we'll have to learn this again. The Gemara will talk, we'll give some more examples. Okay, so now... Okay, but... okay, now, continue. Okay, now... Continue. Alright, so four Tanaim come la'achar Moso. Why do they come la'achar Moso? I don't know. They presumably were not talking to Rabbi Eliezer because, at least according to some Rishon and the Pshat, he was in Chayim. Now, why they had to wait till after he died, I don't know, but Rabbi Eliezer was a terrifying figure. Right? There are any number of agados, stories in Pshat, of people having encounters with him that go awry. Like the Talmud who comes back in Chagiga, is it Rabbi Yosef ben Damascus, who comes and he says, what was the Chiddush in the Beis Medrash today? And he starts to tell him something, and I think he says to him, Pshot yadecha v'tabal yadecha, and his eyes fall out. He then prays and he heals him in the end. I don't know if the story is really literal, but, and goes on to say, tell them they don't need it, the Chiddushim have a Kabbalah lach l'mashim usina, this is the day. So that's not the only encounter. Rabbi Eliezer is a fiery figure, whom encounters often do not go well with in the Gemara. So maybe they just didn't want to do it in his lifetime. I don't know. But when Rabbi Akiva responds, maybe a little disrespectfully to Rabbi Eliezer on the issue of machshirei mitzvah being done on Shabbos for a mitzvah, like machshirei mila, so Rabbi Eliezer is cursing him to die in a particular fashion, which he does. So he is portrayed as a frightening figure who you really want to be careful when you choose to have a conversation. Like if you approach Rav Schechter with a question, Rav Schechter is not terrifying at all. I don't know if you find him, he's really not at all terrifying. But there are some people who you might be scared to approach with a question. I'm not saying anybody here does like Rabbi Eliezer, but there are certain personalities who are more fiery and more, you know, you're a little more scared approaching them. Okay, better Rav Schechter. Me. I'm not scary to approach, I don't think at all. I think not. So anyway, it's Rabbi Eliezer, whatever the reason is, they do lachar mosa. They do lachar mosa. So Rabbi Yeshua is going to say, you know, can't really do it that way. Now, before we look at the response, well, let's start to read the responses. I can't. There's some really. I assume taken none of you have gotten to the Bavli yet. Is that correct? Okay. So, and I don't want to talk about the Bavli now, but I do want to think about. You got to read the Bavli, and you have to read Rashi really, really, really carefully, because Rashi is as always, such an astute reader, and he's recognized some very important conceptual points. But let's start with just as it's presented in the Sifrei. Go ahead. Number one. Yes. Okay, fine. So, cut it. Do a creaseless on him and then bring him back. Okay.
And make sure that there's no other husband in the interim so that.
Yeah, okay.
Don't get on any other knees.
Sure. Fine, go ahead.
Also, the Bible says the echad is hikovar. Ech misaremes loimsa masna mashpasa b'tora. So if woman marries the brother of the koni, so then it will end up being impossible for the yibum with the koni. So loimsa masna mashpasa b'tora. Bchol masna mashpasa b'tora tino b'ata. Alamad
So there's a lot to unpack here. Firstly, this is the simple part of the Yibum question. I want to give a little bit of background because you're going to need this. We have a closeness to doing Sadi Bezim and Bez, which I think is going to make you dizzy and is going to take you a long, long while to figure out. I could be wrong. If you can get it, I will be very impressed and pleased. If you can get it quickly. But you're going to take some time working on it once we kind of work through some more of the sugya. But I want to give you a little background for that that you consider for here as well, because it's going to come up in multiple contexts. The first Mishnah Yevamos, which for some people is torture, is a very basic, it's not the introduction to Yevamos, but it's a very basic din that you need to know about Yevam. Right? The basic din of Yevam is a man dies without any living descendants at the time he dies. And he could have one or more than one wife, and he has a brother, and that brother has a mitzvah to do either yibum, preferably at least midin Torah, in the ideal form, or chalitza to one of his deceased brother's wives. He does either chalitza or yibum with one of them, and all the other wives are mutaros lasha. They are free to go and marry whoever they want. Now he has to do yibum or chalitza on a wife who is eligible to do so. Take the following scenario. A man is married to a woman, and that man's brother is married to his wife's sister. This is not a common occurrence. I don't think I've encountered one yet. I mean, you've heard of one.
I don't know.
What?
Siblings are married to each other?
Yes. It's pretty rare. I know it exists, but it's pretty rare.
Yeah, in fact, they
married
twins.
Oh, that's much for more Jewish people.
Right.
Yeah,
I know people who met their siblings' wedding.
What's that?
I know people who met other siblings.
Listen, you know, I mean, with the twins, it makes perfect sense because if they're an appropriate match, so then they're also probably an appropriate match. Things can get a little confusing there, but nonetheless. But you know, it's not such a common occurrence. So let's say now, Rahman al-Islam, one brother dies without children. So is there a mitzvah evil? So remember that what the mitzvah of Yibum entails is the Torah is explicitly overriding a prohibition of Kares and Erva. Normally, if a man's brother dies with children, if a man divorces his wife and then he dies, doesn't live without children, there is an Isser the Oraisa for his brother to marry that woman because it is an Erva of Eshesach. Ervas Eshesach Chalosek Alei. That applies if he dies with children. It applies if he divorces her. He's never allowed to marry. Once a man marries a woman, that man's brother will never be allowed to marry that wife unless that man dies without any descendants at the time of his death. If he had, but they died before, it's like they never were. And then his brother either has to do Yibam or Chalitza. But in this case, what is odd, Jake, is that his brother's wife is not only his brother's wife, but it is also his wife's sister. In other words, there are when his brother is alive, even if he divorced her, there are two violations, two chiyuvei chataos, two arayas you would violate with one bia. Eishas ach shelo b'makom mitzvah, and achos ishta. Now that his brother dies without children, in theory, the eishas ach, erva should go poof and disappear, but there's still an erva of achos isha. So the halach, this is a machlokes in Shammai Beis Hillel in the following way. Supposing Reuven and Shimon were married to Rachel and Leah. Reuven and Shimon are brothers, Rachel and Leah are sisters. And Reuven dies without children, and Reuven, by the way, had another wife. Reuven, aside from being married to Leah, also was married to Shpinza. Okay, Shpinza is not related to Rachel or Leah, as her name would suggest. And now Reuven dies, and now he has two wives, Leah and Shpinza. So Leah, obviously, you can't do Yibamon. The question is, what about Shpinza? So this was a major, major war between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. It actually is explicitly spelled out as a machlokus in the last mishnah, the first paragraph of Yibamos, but the first mishnah is Beis Hillel's presentation. Beis Hillel says that not only is Leah exempt from needing Yibur Chalitza, but so is Shpinza. She is considered what's called Tsaras HaErva. Leah is the Erva, Shpinza is Tsaras Erva. She's the rival wife, and it's at the time that Reuven dies, he is married to Leah. And Shpinza, the p'tur of Leah extends across all the wives.
And therefore,
there's Isser. There's Isser, Daraisa, Kares remains in effect. Now, one more step in this process just to be aware of. Let's say, not Leah, but Shpinza. It could be Leah also. Let's say there were three brothers, Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. Levi's a bachelor. He's been enjoying the good life. And now, his brother Reuven dies. Now, Levi could do Yibam either on Leah, or on Shpinza. He's going to do it on one or the other, Chalitza, one or the other, and done. And they do need it, because there's a brother who's eligible to do Yibam, therefore they need one of them needs Chalitza to exempt everybody. So now, let's say Levi is Miyabe and Shpinza, the Tzaras Erva. And now, Rachmana Litzlan, Levi dies without children. And Levi, after marrying Shpinza, he liked marriage so much that he married Beatrice. Okay? So now he's married to Beatrice and Shpinza. Beatrice has no connection to anybody else in the family, but Shpinza was his brother Reuven's wife. She was a Tzaras HaErva, which is why Shimon couldn't do Yibam HaChalitza. And now Levi dies. So, can Shimon do Yibam on either of his wives? So the answer is no. Why? He cannot do Yibam on Shpinza, because since when Reuven died, Shpinza was prohibited to Shimon because she was a Tzaras HaErva. She is now labeled as Eishes Ach Shelo B'Mokom Mitzvah forever. She becomes, that's an Erva, Eishes Ach. When she marries Levi, that doesn't disappear. Now, when Levi dies, Shimon cannot do Yibam on Shpinza because that's an Erva, namely Eishes Ach. Since he can't do Yibam on Shpinza, there's no Yibam HaChalitza for Beatrice either. That's called Tzaras, Tzara. And that could go on forever, like Humpty Dumpty, counting up as opposed to down. So the Mishnah says, there are 15, the first Mishnah in Yevamos is, there are Chamesh Esrei Nashim, or Potros Tzaroseim, V'Tzaros Tzaroseim, Min HaYibam, or Min HaChalitza, Ad Sof HaOlam. There are 15 situations, 15 arayos, where someone is an erva to you, but is not an erva to your brother, so your brother can marry them. I gave you one, Achos Ishto, a daughter. We do not look kindly upon this, and it would run afoul of incest laws in America. But the halacha permits uncle marrying a niece, not the reverse. An uncle marrying a niece, and when it comes to a sister's daughter, it's even viewed as a big mitzvah. For genetic reasons, it's probably not a good idea. But the Gemara regards the mitzvah because there will be good shalavayas and so on. So let's say a man marries Bas Achim, his niece, and the man dies. So now it's the daughter. The answer is she doesn't. Because the only erva the Torah permits for Yibum is Eishes Ach of this brother who died. Okay, the Mishnah lists 15 different scenarios. It's 15, but, you know, 6 of them could be collapsed very easily. Yes?
I know this is very good. You should go back more time and explain why the Tzara in the first place is not.
Well, it's a machlokus. Beis Shammai says that when. Did I return your marker, by the way?
What?
Beis Shammai, I should have done it when I did it, so I don't use it anymore. Thank you. So Beis Shammai says that no, it's not that Shpinza couldn't do Yibum with Shimon. You just cross Leah out of the picture. She didn't exist. was not there, was never married, and the remaining wife or wives required Yibum Chalitza. Beishamai Amatir Satsaras La'achim, and they required Yibum Chalitza. Beis Hillel, based upon a drasha, whatever the Dilok in the Gemara, says that once one wife is disqualified, so are all of Erev, because of Erevah. So are all, correct, so are all the other wives. But it's only true by Arayos, by the way. I'm pretty sure, take the following case, this week's parsha. B'hayoha b'chor asher teleid. The parsha of Yibum is this week's, is in Kiseite. B'chor asher teleid, prat la'aylonis, is the drasha. Let's say Shimon is married to a woman who's an eilonis, which is a woman who never went through a proper puberty. It's some type of hormonal thing. He can marry, Reuben can marry her, but when you, let's say he's married to an eilonis and he's married to other women, the way we paskin, I believe, I think there's a day in the Maram not so, but I believe the way we paskin, that when you have an eilonis there, you just cross her out of the picture. And if she has a tzara, then you need Yibum Chalitza. Unlike for Beis Hillel by Arayos, where once one wife is an erava to this brother, they're all disqualified to that brother. They don't, they can't have yibum. They don't need chalitza. They're all free to go, assuming there are no other brothers. So an eilonis doesn't disqualify her rivals. I think the way we assume in the Mishnah, it's about, and there's a sheet in Amoran, I think Rab or something. But an eilonis might not disqualify anybody else. Just she is disqualified. Okay. So now come to this. What, Yoni? Ask the question. Ask the question. Now. Ask it. Excellent question. I wasn't going to tell you this now, but it's going to come up in discussions in Rishonim in our sugya. So let me give you, if I'm overwhelming you, tell me to stop. I'm trying to do this as sort of basic details. So Yoni asked the question, what if the Erevah dies, right? And so she's not in the picture anymore. That's your question? So that's part of the Mishnah as well. The Mishnah says, V'kulam shemesu or miskarshu omiyanu or nimsu aylonis, forget that last part, so tzorosem or mutaros. Now, there is one area of agreement on one end and one area of agreement on another end and a big machlokas in the middle. But this is also crucial. It comes up in the Mefarshim here. Yoni asked the following. Reuven is married to Shprinsa and to Leah. And then Reuven dies, so we say that we pass on Beis Hillel, Tzaros Arpturos, Arasuros. So we say Leah and Shprinsa have a nice life. Goodbye. What happens if Leah, his wife's sister, Reuven's sister, dies? So it depends when she dies. In some cases, everybody agrees it doesn't matter. In some cases, everybody agrees she's out of the picture and there's regular Yibum Chalitza v'Shprinsa. And in one case, there's a major machlokas for the major conceptual difference. The case, Yoni, that everybody agrees is, let's say, Leah dies after Reuven dies. Reuven dies, and right now, Leah and Shprinsa would be theoretically eligible for Yibum Chalitza, but there's only Shimon right now. Only Shimon right now. And Shimon cannot do Yibum on Leah because it's his wife's sister. And therefore we say they're both Peturos. And now all of a sudden, Leah Rahman, let's say that's a heart attack and drops dead. Now, can Shimon do Yibam on Shprinsa? So the answer is absolutely not. Everybody agrees why. Well, this is a basic issue of fairness and justice to Shprinsa. If you say that now there's a mitzvah Yibam Achalitza, well, poor Shprinsa, even before Leah dies, she never knows what's going to be. She's afraid to get remarried because maybe her rival wife will die. Now, this happens to be part of a broader principle, and tell me if I'm going to confuse you, that the rule is that at the time of Yibum, meaning the time where people should become eligible for Yibum, the death of the brother, it's called Shas Nefila, when she is Nofelas Lefanav. If at that time you cannot do Yibum Achalitza, she's Asur forever. We say, Kevan Shenesra Lav Shachas, Nesra Lav Olam. I'll give you an example where there's no justice problem, but nonetheless it matters. I gave you the example before. Shprinsa, when a married lady, the next brother, who had no problems. And now Leah drops dead for whatever reason. And now, I'll diagram.
Could you give us some of the first to actually look at it inside about this? That almost more of a visual
So most of this is the first Mishnah.
I'll take 2 weeks.
The first Mishnah of Yavamas. What I've said until now so far is really all there.
Okay, let's say we have Reuben, Mary, and Shimon, and Levi. So the colors indicate their siblinghood, okay? Married to Leah, married to Rachel, okay?
So Leah and Rachel are siblings.
Leah and Rachel are siblings, yes. They're a host, that's the point. So now, Reuben dies. So Shimon can't even be a man. Now, what happens is Leah goes, and she now marries, she gets married to Levi because they choose to do evil. Okay? Now, Rachel dies. And now, Levi dies. I'm killing a lot of people here right now. I'm a deadly guy. Now, what are we looking at? We're looking at a situation where if Shimon wanted to do evil on Leah, he should be able to because Leah is not his wife's sister anymore. Because, by the way, wife is the only two arayos that could, once they become usher, can become mutter. What are the two? Three, technically. There are only three arayos that can ever become mutter. And only two of them are automatic with the death of the Yosef. What are the? Well, one of them is obviously Eshesach. But it's not mutter when the brother dies, unless he dies childless. What's the second one?
The one we're doing right
now. Now, a man is married to a woman, he may not marry her sister. If he divorces his wife, he may not marry her sister. However, if his wife dies, before or after divorce, doesn't matter. He's allowed to marry her sister. What's the third erva that becomes mutter with the death of the Yosef? Heshetish, a married woman. Her husband dies, then she's with us. Now, so you're going to look at this and say, wait, why not have Shimon ben Yibam now? The answer is no. Kevan shenetzra alav sha'achas. Because at the time Reuben died, Leah, in a situation of Yibam, became asura. To Shimon, she's asura to all of them. Now, she gets labeled Ishas Ach Shalom Malka Mitzvah forever. Okay, so that's what I started by saying. Someone asked the question. You only asked the question. Yes, Shimon?
But if Shimon had never married Rachel in the first place, but...
Hold on, just wait. Let me finish and then I may answer your question. So the starting point is that even though there was no injustice done here, right, because Leah wasn't free anyway. She went and married Levi, the third brother. Now that Shimon's wife has died, he still can't do Yibam when Levi dies. Because since Leah was Nesra Lav Sha'achas, when Reuven died, she's Asura Lav forever. That's the case where everybody agrees that even though the Erva has died, the Tzara will remain Asura. So even to the simple case, I know there's justice also, but Reuven was married to Leah in Shprinsa. Reuven dies, Shimon can't do Yibam right now, all of a sudden Leah drops dead, Shimon still doesn't do Yibam on Shprinsa, she's free to go. Because the death there doesn't help you if it has occurred after the Shas Yibam, the Shas Nefila. Now, let me give you the case that everybody agrees is mutter. Reuven was married to Leah and Shprinsa. Shimon hasn't yet married Rachel. Shimon can marry Rachel, that's fine. Reuven divorces Leah, and he now marries Shprinsa. Reuven dies, everybody agrees Shimon can do Yibam on Shprinsa. Why? Because Shprinsa and Leah were never rival wives. They were never married to Reuven at the same time. Okay, so she's never, there's no way to call her a Tzaras Ha'erva because they were never Tzaras. The Machlokas case is, supposing Reuven is married to Leah and Shprinsa when Shimon is married to Rachel. Now, Leah drops dead. And at this point, Leah and Shprinsa are no longer rival wives. They were rival wives once upon a time when Reuven married them. But, and let me frame it this way. Reuven was married to Shprinsa. He now marries Leah. At the time of his marriage to Leah, Shprinsa is now a Tzaras Ha'erva. Now Leah drops dead. She's no longer a Tzaras Ha'erva. And then Reuven dies. That's a machlokes ha'amorayim, whether or not Shprinsa is allowed to have evil with Shimon. It depends upon the following question. I've used the language of nefila. Nefila means the Yavama is nofeles lefnei hayabam v'yibam. She basically falls into his domain for needing you b'chalitza. Now, the machlokas is, what causes the obligation of yibam? Is it nisuim harishonim mapilim or misas ha'ach mapeles? What generates the obligation of yibam? Is it the brother's original marriage to his wives? Or is it the death of the brother? Obviously, it's contingent upon the brother dying without children. But is it nisuim harishonim mapilim or misas ha'ach mapeles? If you believe that it is misas ha'ach, which is mapeles, that generates the obligation of yibam, then it's not a problem for Reuven, for Shimon to do yibam on Shprinza, because when Reuven died at that time, Leah was out of the picture through divorce, through death, and therefore at the time that Reuven dies, Shprinza is not a tzaras erev anymore, Shimon can do yibam. But if you believe that nisuim harishonim are mapilim, then as long as Reuven at any point was married to Leah and Shprinza, then that already generates a title of tzaras ha'erva, and when Reuven dies, Shimon may not do yibam. This machlok is about nisuim harishonim, or misa sa'ach, is going to come up in some of the parsha. Remember, it's the parsha Yishalmi, if it's the Yishalmi of the Bavli, the issue is going to come up. So that's I think, the basic hakdama you should be aware of. Some of it is really basic. The rules of the erva and tzaras ha'erva are simple. This is a little more complicated, which is, you can't see it there, which is the question of what generates the chiyuv of yibam, the nisuim harishonim or the misa sa'ach, and that will determine whether or not a shimi, a erva who's now out of the picture, it determines whether or not she will cancel her tzara or not. Yes, Jim?
So how is that relevant here?
How is that relevant? Why am I giving you this hashgama here? Well, because the opening, the Gemara assumes that there's going to be a problem disqualifying somebody from Yibam. And as we're going to see, the Rishonim and the Yushalmi asks a question. Did you notice the Yushalmi's question? The Yushalmi asked, find it. Not there, hold on. I'm not making it up. And then the question of Nesvi Shesh Esrei Nashim Karabi Eliezer. The first Mishnah of Yavamos lists 15. But according to Rabbi Eliezer, you could get a 16th at Saras Erva. You know what the Arayas are in the Mishnah? I'd give anybody a bonus if they could name it. It's Bito, Bas Mino, Bas Ishto, Bas Mino, Bas Bito. Chamoso, Eim Chamoso, Eim Chamiv. All those 9 Arayas of the 15 are just Isho Bito. The rule in the Torah is, if you're married to woman X, you may not have Bia with any woman within 2 generations of her. Her grandmother's mother, daughter, granddaughters. That's all included in Ervas Isha Ubitala Sigalei. That's 9 of the 15 in the Mishnah. And then you have Achos Ishto, you have Ishas Achiv Me'imo. Yibam only applies to brothers from the father. I don't want to go, you can, if you look up the case, Ishas Achiv Shalei Ba'olamo, Kalaso, it has to be people who could only marry, it's Achoso Me'imo and Achos Imo. Those, I think, are the 15. Now, there could be a 16th. You know what we would call it? Ashish. Right? In other words, you can have a Yibam situation where, let's take this woman. Let's say, this is the case that everybody has in the Braise. This is the Rabbi Karpa. Let's say a man divorced his wife and said, you can marry everybody except for Shimon. And she goes and marries Shimon's brother, Reuven. And now, Reuven dies. Well, can she have Yibam with Shimon? Why not? What's the issue?
She's not divorced.
She's an Ashes Ish. So, number one, she can't marry Shimon because she's an Ashes Ish with respect to Shimon. If she's an Arab of Ashes Ish with respect to Shimon, maybe her Tsaras also can't do Yibam with Shimon. It's Tsaras Arab.
Can you do that one more time?
Absolutely. Oh, when you get pitosis, you're really going to have fun. You've got a while till there. Okay. Man divorces a woman, says you can marry everybody but that no good Nick Shimon. Fine, so she goes and marries no good Nick Shimon's brother, Reuven. Reuven dies without any living descendants. Now, can Shimon do, and he has another wife too. He has this woman and another wife. Is Shimon allowed to be Yibam?
Sorry, who has this woman and another wife?
Reuven, the guy she was allowed to marry, the brother of the no good Nick. So the question is, can she do Yibam now with Shimon? And the answer is no, as Shimon said, because with respect to Shimon, she's an issue, she's still married. So now I want to know, can she do Yibam with Reuven's, can Reuven's other wife do Yibam? And the answer should be no, because she's a Tzaras Ha'erva. What's the Erva? Eishes Ish. In other words, there should be 16 Aliyahs from the Mishnah, according to Rabbi Eliezer, that one's brother can marry, but they can't. Namely, Eishes Ish. See?
She's the wife of the original? She's still...
Yeah, Reuven is dead, right?
Reuven is dead, yes.
So why is his wife in Eishes Ish?
From the original marriage. She was married to Jackson.
Oh.
Jackson gave her a get and said, I don't know why the name came into my head. It's not a kind of name. I mean, other than the water crisis, but Jackson gives her a get and says, Haret with prayers of Chaldam except for Shimon. She goes and marries Shimon's brother Reuven. Reuven dies without any descendants. Now she requires Yibam a Chalita, theoretically. But she can't do Yibam because she's an Erva with respect to Shimon because she's an Eishes Ish. So if she can't do Yibam, fine. Now what about her rival wives? Should be a Tzaras Erva. So when the Mishnah lists all 15 Arayas, we can add, according to Rabbi Eliezer, Eishes Ish. Right? Correct. Beisham, I would say, of course, even if she is an Erva, the Tzara is in the Tzara. But then the question, anyway, so that is the background of your Lamas. So you get 1.5 credits of your Lamas for that. So. Okay, if you can spit it back to me, not now. Okay, but then you want, that's the basic background of your Lamas that you need to know in different parts of the Sigur. To understand the Yerushalmi, you needed most of that. You didn't need to know, Yisum HaRishonim HaPilim or Misam HaPelas. That's a very rare detail that's going to come up, but the larger point about Erva and Tzaras HaErva is something that you should know and you should know well. It's a basic din, first Mishnah Yivam. Okay. So, Rabbi Tarfon says, that's only the first. We haven't started Rabbi Tarfon even yet. Okay. He says that if she goes and marries his brother and he dies without any descendants, how can she have Yibam? Now, your answer might be, okay, well, she can't. Why can't she?
You're talking about Leah, right?
Leah.
She's an
Eishes Ish. Okay. Fine. Now, let's continue. That's an assumption that we're going to challenge at some point, but we're going to accept it for now. Yerushalmi will accept it, and I don't want to explain why, but go ahead. Well, actually, Jake, no. I actually want you to explain it. Why is she an Eishes Ish?
Because the original husband said you're only allowed to get a divorce if you don't marry this guy.
Ooh, I have a question for you. If he gave her a get and said, this is your get as long as you don't drink wine forever. Now, if you weren't concerned about Chrysos as a technical thing, that we have to sever the bond, that they're no longer, she's no longer tied to him, would you say that that's not a get? It's a get. So he's just, that's just the way you just said it, this is your get, but you can't marry so-and-so. Right? Is that, I'm spilling too much beans, but you were just asking for it. Is that not a get? Or is it just a condition?
Isn't that exactly what
I hear
talking
about the
beginning?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Why don't you talk about that? Because I'm just, I'm teasing you. I'm
spewing
a tease. I don't
want to spill the beans. You're talking about the
word Hamadarish. No, the word Ella. That's the question of what Ella means. Does Ella mean Chutz or Ella mean Amanas? That's the Gemara's question. I just want you to recognize that there's an assumption that we're going to have to really explore that. Is it that she's an Eishes Ish with respect to this guy, or is it that she can't marry this guy? it has to be for this to make sense. And the Bavli will point this out if one is a conceptualist. That it's not that it's a condition. The condition leaves you in a fascinating catch-22. She's not an Eishes Ish with respect to him right now. You know why? Because she hasn't married him. So then she needs Yibum or Chalitza. The problem is, if she does Yibum, she will now become an Eishes Ish and will never have been divorced.
Sounds like
fucking Yibum or Chalitza. Okay. Yeah, we're going to talk about that a little bit.
Are we talking about the Sunnah entry?
Tosfos makes it out. What's that?
Are we talking about the Sunnah entry, the condition?
Correct. If you say that it's not a condition, but it's a definition of what the Gerushin is, you are Megureshes with and permissible, and the definition of Gerushin is the Ikar of the Get is what? Hareat Muteris L'chol Adam. So this Get is Hareat Muteris L'chol Adam except for so-and-so. It means, with respect to so-and-so, it's not that you can't marry so-and-so because it will undo the Get. It means you're married to me with respect to so-and-so. Which, by the way, we're going to see in the Bible, and this is the part we're skipping over, drills down to, as bizarre as it sounds, what is Kiddushin? It might actually be progressive. Kiddushin is not that the woman belongs to the husband. Kiddushin is that the woman is a surah to cohabit with everybody else.
Oh, including the husband.
Well, no, not including the husband, normal case.
How is it progressive?
Well, it's not that... How is it progressive? It's not that... It's fine. It's more progressive. Right? In other words, it's not that the husband has a certain kind of bailus as much as her personal... She has a certain kind of kiddushin. It's called kiddushin. That's what the Gemara in the first Sugi kiddushin says. Right? That the definition of kiddushin is being nester to other people, as opposed to being property of the husband. Right? The second part, Isha Nikneis, focuses on that. Again, she's not property of the husband. It's a personal status transformation. It's a kini issu, not a kini mamon. But nonetheless, it's a very different perspective. We're going to see when we do the opening part of the Bavli after we've done the Brises that they really drill down to what the definition of Kiddushin and Gerushin is. Anyway, so Gerushin is defined as being matzahar to others. So if you say that she's muteris to all but, as opposed to all on the condition that, all but means it's not a complete Gerushin. Okay, now. So Rabbi Tarfon, that doesn't bother Rabbi Tarfon, though. Rabbi Tarfon is bothered by the fact that if she were to go and marry the no-goodnik's brother, and now the no-goodnik's brother were to die without any living descendants, you would need Yibum, but you couldn't have it because she's an Erva. And what's the problem with that? It's Nimsa Masna Masha Kasa B'Torah. V'chala Masna Ma... Go ahead. What? Yeah, I'm not even going to focus on that. There's something more for the Bavli. By the way, of all the Brises, the Bavli has different language here. Yeah.
If you read it the other way, then you would say, it's not a problem. It's Erevan. She would just be fine to go anywhere else. It wouldn't even be an issue.
If you read it, which, if you read what, which way?
If you read it as it's a chutzni instead of an issue as that, then it wouldn't be a problem at all.
So you're already giving what is the Bavli's response to saying why Rabbi Tarfon's raya is a bad raya, right? What you've recognized already is you're very well intuited. The one Gemara, Rava says that all of them have a tshuva except for Rav Elazar ben Azariah. What's the tshuva to Rabbi Tarfon's taina? The tshuva is, so if that's the case, you shouldn't marry your brother's daughter either, because should he die without children, then you've done away with the mitzvah evil. So the answer is no. The Torah did away with it. Now the answer might be the Torah does away with the mitzvah Yibum. That's what the Yerushalmi says. Whereas here, he's doing away with the mitzvah Yibum. But yes, but fundamentally, you're correct. That would be, you know, you might just say, so what? And that just happens to be in this case. She's an Erev. Okay. Now, leaving aside, Daniel, the question of Masneh, let's assume for the moment it is really Masneh, Masha Kasa the Torah, there's a problem with this statement. And I think there's a reason why the Bavli has different language. The Bavli says, Hareza nimtza oker davar min ha-Torah. And what's the problem with Masna Mashiach HaTorah? What, fine? Yeah. If you say it's a Masna, so here I have to step back. I don't know if we're going to do this sugya, even though it's relevant to do at some point, but I'm going to give you a Rashi Krakam with the sugya. If I walk up to a woman and I say, if it is raining outside, if these are your kiddushin. I think it's raining. It's close enough. Okay? No, it's not raining, actually, right? Okay. Are we married?
It's not
raining. Are we married?
No.
Yes, we are.
Oh, why?
Why? No. No, I can marry her now, marry her based upon, you know, maybe that's perfectly fine. It might be silly, but it's not Moshe 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 Moshe. Why are we not married? Why are we married, Ephraim? Because in order for a Tanai to be valid and to regulate a Maisa applying, you have to satisfy the Mishpatei HaTanai.
Oh, right.
When Moshe Rabbeinu divides the land up of Eber HaYarden and gives it to 2.5 Shvatim, he says, Im yavru v'nei gadu v'nei ruvein etchem es ha-yardein kol chalutz lamelcham alafnei Hashem v'nech b'sharetz lefnechem unisatem lohem es eretz ha-gilal b'achuzah. And then Moshe Rabbeinu, who was not known for being verbose, and the Torah certainly not, v'im lo yavru chalutzim etchem enoch azul v'sachem eretz kanan. Why did he have to, we understood. Jake, if you carry all my sperm for me from the base medrash to my office, said, I'll buy you pizza for lunch. What will happen if Jake doesn't carry my sperm?
You'll also buy
these clothes. Oh, we don't know.
He will understand that as soon that wouldn't be the case.
Well, you didn't specify what happened.
It wouldn't work here, by the way. Here you wouldn't get, Jake, you won't get the pizza. There's a reason why you won't get the pizza. But if we made a kinyan on lunch money, if I had you pick up my $10 for lunch, can you still buy lunch for $10?
No, no. Yeah,
pizza store you can certainly buy for $10. Okay.
So
if I made a kinyan now, and saying that if you boo my sperm, you make a kinyan and through my sperm, the money is yours, then it might be whether you do or don't. Maybe. But in principle, the principle would be your money out of my. But not in that particular case, for technical reasons. In order, if you do a maisa, kiddushin, gerushin, some say it's only that the Rambam quotes the Gaon, others say it's all dine mamonos. And you do not have a tzai kafel, which means you spell out yes and no, and the yes is not before the no, and you have to do the maisa before you actually, you have to do the tzai before the maisa. You can't give the woman a kiddushin and then say, oh, it's your kiddushin if you do the following. No, no, that's too good. You have to first say, this will be your kiddushin if such and such, okay, then give her the ring, then the condition. You need tzai kafel, which means yes and no. You need pain kodem alav, that the positive clause must be first. You need snai kodem lemaisa. And then there are a couple other requirements. It has to be a davash esha lekaima, which we will see in our sutra. If you give a woman a get and say, this is your get, if you climb, if you jump off the top of the Empire State Building and survive on the fall, then she's migureshes and she doesn't have to test the proposition. Because it's a tanaish esha lekaima. And if you're masna o masha kasa betorah, for example, anybody who will be doing that, Yomi will have encountered this. A man goes up to a woman. He's got a little cold feet about getting married, so he says, you know, listen, ma'am, I'm willing to marry you, but I can't take on my financial responsibilities. Haram mikudeshes, libe tabaso, kudas moshe yisrael almanas, that she'en lach alai sher ksutzvahona, that I am not bound to provide for you any of the three basic obligations of marriage. We paskin, like Rabbi Yehuda, that if you mask no masha kasa b'tara b'davash b'mamon, t'neu kayim. But anything else, it's not. So everybody agrees that we're married, and I have to provide for ona, cohabitation. It's a machlokas whether the tzanai on the mamon is kayam or not, between Rabbi Huda and Ramir. Ramir says, tzanai even by those shemamon is batel. Rabbi Huda says it's kayam, we pass them that way. But even if the tzanai is batel, the mais is kayam. That's the din. That's the way, that's why most Rabbeinu have to be kofal the tzanai. Therefore, as Ephraim has noted, what's strange about calling this masna mashal kasa pera, forgetting that the tzanai, is that if you're masna masha kasa batorah, if that's the problem, then the answer is tanai is bata and maisa kalim. So she's megureshes and she is mutaris lachaladim. You ignore the tanai. Now the Bavli doesn't say that. It says hareis nim says ve okir dafar ben haTorah. And I think there's a reason for that. And I think it's really important. And I think the Bavli hit the nail on the head. I think the language of the other brises is not precise. It may be the way the Bavli understands them. There's very good reason for it. Yes, Daniel. I think nobody would read Rabbi Kaffa that way. What Daniel is making a very important point, though, which we could have said on the Mishnah, is that there actually are three options that were a possibility that you could have laid out, and only two are opted for by the Tanaim. When he gives a get, which is Aramri Parashal called on Chutz to so-and-so, one option is to say the get is no good. One option is to say that the get is good, but the condition works. And the third option is to say the get is good, and the condition is batal, and she is Mutaris Lachal Adam. Right? That really, once you understand something about Mishpat HaTanan, you might be wondering why. Jake, you're kind of wondering, why is this so? It's so counterintuitive. So the answer to that question is the following. The idea that a Tanai itself can regulate Kiddushin, or Gerushin for that matter, is somewhat radical. Let me take an example of a Tanai, which you will certainly understand that the fact that a Tanai works is radical. Let's say a man, not behaving the way a good Ben Yeshiva should behave, goes to his girlfriend and is Mekadisha with Bia. Now, he makes a Tanai. Now, is he serious about the Tanai? Like, really? You're having sex with your girlfriend here. To consummate a marriage, and you make a Tanai. But if, like you see, when you have a Kiddushe Kesef, and you're Mekadish Al Tanai, and the Tanai is not fulfilled, you know what's going to happen then? She'll give you the ring back for your next girlfriend. If you write the Shtar for Kiddushin Al Tanai, what's going to happen if the Tanai isn't fulfilled? Take the Shtar and tear it up. If you had Bia with her, what are you going to say about that? Like, oh, sorry? I mean, so what we would say...
No, there wasn't.
So there's a chazak in other most of bilasa bilasas, which you could override here if you're explicit. But the point is, what's
not very explicit?
What?
This is not the solution if certain things happen. They didn't happen, therefore you were explicit.
Let me ask you a question. Can you do I have to look at this. Can you do shchit alat tonight? Why not?
It's
dead. The sheep is done.
It's not a status change. It's not a verbal status
change. I understand. But what I'm saying, Daniel, is the idea that you can take even a gerushin, even a shtar kiddushin, the idea that you can perform the mice and say, but I'm just kidding, I didn't really mean it, that's not so clear. Right? It's a chiddush that a tanaim can be used to regulate it. And the assumption that we work with, the way that we show them and explain Mishpat HaTanaim, is that when you perform certain actions, the assumption is, you're really serious about those actions. And if you do not go out of your way to make the Tanai in a formal, legalistic way as required, we're seeing it, you're not really serious about the Tanai. That's why I'm going to have to talk. But the mice you're serious about because it's something that you're doing. I'll say this as the last thing. We'll stop here, but I want to tell you about a very important Tosis and Kiddushin you should always keep in your back pocket. There are a lot of Gemaras that you will learn that don't seem to require Mishpat HaTanai. And you say, well, how come this is valid? There's no Mishpat HaTanai here. And the Bali HaTosos in Kiddushin Daf Mem Pesach Amud Beis, the case of the Gemara is a guy sold his house because he was making Aliyah, and then Nefesh B'Nefesh discovered that he couldn't make Aliyah for whatever reason. He wasn't able to go, and now he comes back to the Nisim who bought his house and says, Nisim, I want my house back because I only sold to make Aliyah and I can't make Aliyah. And Nisim says, no backseat, sir. What are you talking about? Now the Gemara implies that if I had said, Nisim, I'm selling you my house because I'm making Aliyah, that you would have to give me my house back. The problem is I didn't say anything. People knew I was going, but I didn't in any way connect it. But it sounds from the Gemara that I don't have to make formal mishpat HaTanai when I sell you my house before I make Aliyah. I just have to say, I have to be Megala Nilsa, I need a Gilu Das, that I'm planning to make Aliyah, and that's connected to the selling of the house. So the Baal HaPosfos make the following observation, that depending upon how obvious something is, that it would be a condition attached to any given sale, determines what level I need to spell out. Sometimes Tosfos says we have a Tanai that's called Dvarim Shebelivo Uvelev Kol Adam. Everybody knows that's what's underlying. No, everybody looks at this. You don't need to say a word. Everybody knows that Tanai is relevant there. There Tosfos says you don't need to say a word. It's Dvarim Shebelivo Uvelev Kol Adam. Sometimes Tosfos says it's not Dvarim Shebelivo Kol Adam. It's only Dvarim Shebelivo because it could be you're doing it for multiple reasons. But it's a pretty obvious reason, and if you spell out the reason without going through Mishpat HaTanai, then that reason, that Tanai, governs the thing, even though you didn't use Tanai Kafol and Hin Kodam Lav and Lav Kodam and Tanai Kodam Maisa, etc. And sometimes the linkage between the two is sufficiently not obvious that in order for the Tanai to govern the applicability of the Maisa, you have to spell out all the Mishpat HaTanai. if you're interested by the field, where I believe it's the Mishnah Pe'atanan, I believe it's a Mishnah Kedushin, the third part, I think, Kol Tanai She'enu Kaftanai Gadol Tanai B'nei Ruvein is not valid. Nor is Tanai to govern the Maaseh. But that Tosis, the three parts, depending on how clear it is, how obvious the linkage is between Tanai and the given Tanai and Ethical Maaseh. So if it's so obvious, everybody knows it, you don't have to say a word. If it's an obvious connection, but it's not compelling, not muchrach, then you need gilui daita. It's enough to just make a das, you don't need the formal mishnah pe'atanan. If it is really not at all obviously connected, then in order for the tanai to be mevatel the maisa, and if it is not fulfilled, it requires all the mishnah pe'atanan. And the rule is, in a case where you require mishnah pe'atanan, then, and by the way, then obviously any tanai which is iyash on the kaimo is obviously would have required mishnah pe'atanan, because if it's iyash on the kaimo, it's not obviously connected. So, but the rule is when you require mishnah pe'atanan, any time if the tanai is iyash on the kaimo, the tanai is bat on the maisis kaim. When you master the mashe kasa v'tera by davar she'eno shamano, like mekadesh and isha amanashe ein lach alai ona. You're married, you're chayav an ona. Tanai batal umaisa chayav. So the formulation of the Tosefta is very odd, because masna mashal kasav Torah should have yielded, as Ephraim said, and Daniel opened that possibility, a get without any restrictions. But that's not one of the two opinions in the Mishnah. So Rabbi Tarfon, and what are the last words, Ephraim? And this is the most problematic part. Go ahead. Yeah. What in God's name does that mean? I understand Master Masha Kasa Batora, Tanai Batel Maisa Kayan, Tanai Batel Maisa Batel, Inze Krisus. We will resume tomorrow.